be very brief. Are
you introducing me?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was Henry.
No. Henry's doing some releases.
Ah. I'd prefer to take them at the end.
Everybody has, actually. Yes.
Yeah, but I'm quite happy to take questions.
Okay, I think we'll make a start, actually. My name's Neil Newman. I'm Branch Network Manager at AAT. Can I just check that everyone's got a copy of the handouts for this session? If you haven't, then there will be some on a table next to you. We've got plenty that are on the tables. So if I can just introduce our speaker for the session, Derek Allen, and Derek's going to be covering tax efficiency. Derek's also told me that he's happy to take questions throughout the session. So if anyone's got a question, then we have a couple of roving mics at the back. So if you just give us a couple of seconds to get to you so everyone can hear the question. Is that okay? Great, thank you. Over to you, Derek.
Thank you, Neil. Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome. Thanks very much for coming along. I do like a bit of positive feedback, and as Neil says, I'm quite happy to take questions, but I would prefer to take them at the end. I'm hoping to leave about 10 to 15 minutes at the end of today so that we can have questions and answers then. But I'm hoping that you can all hear me, and those at the back, if you could nod your head that it's coming through, thank you. More importantly, can you understand me? And I don't actually mean the regional accent there. I was conscious that there are different variations. I used to work for Arthur Anderson. It's something that most people keep quiet about, but I was very proud to work for Arthur's. And I very, very quickly learnt that they have a different language. When I talked about stock, the US clients talked about inventory. And if I was talking about stock, if they were talking about stock, they actually meant equity. But the thing that really brought it home one day was I was drafting a letter in pencil and I made a mistake and I put my hand up and said, "Has anybody got a rubber?" And they all said, "We don't use that phraseology in this company." So I think at this stage I should probably make it clear that the views that I'm going to express are personal. And they should not be taken as representative of either my employer, the Institute of Chartered Accountants of Scotland, or AAT, because I'm going to be at some times a wee bit controversial. And begin by saying avoidance is legal. And therefore, tax planning is a perfectly acceptable thing to do. And I've provided you with a paper which was written at the 28th of February, but I've tried to update it as far as possible with everything that was in the budget and subsequent finance bill this year. I always think, as the paper says, the Lord's Prayer's got 56 words, and yet this year's finance bill alone has got 670 pages. And frankly, it's not a right riveting read. It requires 508 pages of explanatory notes that tells you that tax is difficult and mistakes are inevitable. And I think when we're looking at any business, we've got to balance the risk with the reward. And we've got to understand some of the risk factors that are going to have an adverse effect. And I'm not talking about actually getting something wrong. I'm talking about a risk factor that is basically like a red flag to a bull, something like an employee benefit trust. Perfectly legal, but HMRC will automatically ratchet up the risk assessment if you've got one in place. So I'm actually going to concentrate today on what I would call the plain vanilla, the risk-free. And there's a quote in the paper that says, for example, salary sacrifice and taking advantage of the exemptions which are within the statute is not avoidance. That's HMRC's description. I would say they're being excessively kind, or they're trying to obfuscate the difference between avoidance and evasion. And let me say clearly, evasion is intolerable and nobody should condone it, but avoidance is perfectly legal, and it's just planning to minimise the tax and planning to ensure that rewards are recognised and made in the most tax-efficient way, and therefore you're also increasing the business's bottom-line profitability. But I would emphasise that point. If you go to aggressive tax planning, you can always be certain that it can face a challenge. And if it doesn't work, you've got a very hostile client. One of my roles within ICAS is to advise the investigation committee where a complaint is made and it's on a tax technical point. And I don't comment on the rights and the wrongs other than to give a technical report on what's happened. But I can tell you that when avoidance schemes come unstuck, and the ships one is a classic second-hand insurance policy scheme, when it comes unstuck, you get some really hostile clients who will have paid a lot of money for a scheme that doesn't work, and they are looking around for people to blame and complain about. And it's very important that if you enter the murky waters, I shouldn't really call them murky waters, but if you enter tax planning and avoidance, you have to get it right. You have to be more careful, because we're now faced with a penalty regime that under the penalties introduced by Schedule 24 Finance Act 2007, it's based on behaviour. But the revenue has a sliding scale of what they see as a measure of reasonable care. And to somebody who is poorly educated, they will be very tolerant of mistakes. But if you go into the area of planning to minimise your tax, you have to get it right. And the standard of the bar is much, much higher. So it's very important, again, when you're starting to go into that area of planning to minimise tax, that you do keep in mind the risk and the reward, and that if you're going into it, you make sure that the client understands the risk and the reward as well, because it's something that has to be borne in mind. The cost of a dispute is actually sometimes overwhelming. Now, the good news is we'll be finishing with lunch, and research also shows that very early on in any lecture, after about 5 to 10 minutes, even the most industrious and assiduous person starts to sort of daydream and have sexual fantasies and everything. And yet we're down for an hour and 30 minutes. I think about the sexual fantasy thing and think it's good to know I'll be giving you all so much pleasure after about 10 minutes. But it's also good to know that we've got some serious topics to get through. And I did want to emphasise right at the start, when you were all still awake, this element of balancing the risk and the reward. And to say, something like an employee benefit trust, we'll call it an EBT because it's quicker to say, is still a useful thing for deferring income. This year we're going to have really high earners dropping from 50% or 52% down to 45%. And using an EBT would be a useful way of deferring the recognition of income until the rate has lowered. But you're going to carry with it significant risks. And of course, you've got this payment from third party in Finance Act 2011. We've got the disguised remuneration legislation found in Part 7A of ITPA. Trust me in this, you just don't want to go there. It's horrific reading, and it's really difficult to understand. So what I'm going to say is that I'm concentrating today on what I would call the plain vanilla areas, but I would also emphasise that there's a great opportunity to make substantial savings, both for the employer and ensuring they get the most advantageous capital allowances, and on the employee in getting something that's valuable. Tax is one of these areas where it's also constantly changing. And when we look at the risk areas for inquiries of a business as published by HMRC, we see that there's a sort of recurrence to it. VAT is often wrong, business profits and the offset of losses is an area of challenge. Capital gains tax is challenged, and yet when you look at the yield from capital gains tax and the total number of people who are liable to pay tax, it's only about 300,000 to 350,000 people a year. The level of emphasis that HMRC give to it is very interesting. Whereas we've actually got 24 million employees, and this is an area where even a small saving to one employee multiplied across a workforce can produce a very substantial saving, but the converse is get it wrong and you can have a very big problem there. Other areas like status, I mean, HMRC have been on the warpath about status for well over a decade, and I understand John mentioned the recommendations for simplification on status yesterday, but the reality is it's an area of challenge. There are, of course, very substantial opportunities by making somebody self-employed as a worker. The employer saves substantial amount of national insurance. The worker can save substantial amount of national insurance because of the differential rates. The savings look like a win-win position for everyone until you look at the history of decided cases. And if you look back at the status cases and you look back at the IR35 cases that come before the first tier tribunal, historically it takes 8 years to get there. And imagine being in dispute with HMRC for 8 years and the diversion of management resource. It's something that is just not worth doing. And if you're going to arrange to be self-employed to achieve those state savings, then you've got to make sure that you do it right. Now, I feel it's very easy. It's a matter of contractual arrangement. You would introduce a real right of substitution, and you would introduce a demonstrable factual evidence that there was no mutuality of obligation. And you might be saying, how do you do that? And it's very simple. I offer to contract with you. You say, yes, thanks very much. Will you do it for £500 a day? I say, no, thank you. And you come back and say, would you do it for £600 a day? I say, no, thank you. You come back and say, would you do it for £610? And I say, thanks very much. There's an evidential exchange there that there was no mutuality of obligation, and therefore you are definitely self-employed. And it's quite easy to arrange that. But of course, what happens in the commercial world is you get to the end of that short contract and you turn around and say, you're coming back on Monday for the same terms? Yes. You're going into the metamorphosis, going back into employment. So you need to dot the I's and cross the T's, because getting that wrong builds up a big pay-as-you-earn liability that, you know, it's going to result in eventually a visit with a Regulation 80 assessment and a Section 8 NIC, which is the real big one, and it's something that you can do without. They've also high in the risk area at the moment, service companies. After the scandal has broken about Ed Lester, who's getting paid a very large salary, so the question was asked, how many other civil servant positions above £58,000 are getting paid using a service company? And the answer comes back over 2,000. So you can almost be certain that they're going to be challenging these service companies, either looking through it using IR35 or, and I'm so glad that Mike covered it earlier, deeming whatever it is to be remuneration using the PA Holdings Limited decision and challenging it for NIC. And of course, the real impact there is the dispute time. I simply want to tell you how not to get into those areas of dispute. Avoiding it is better than facing the challenge. But one thing to make sure is, if you get it wrong, HMRC do actually have good evidence that non-compliance in one area, whatever it might be, is often accompanied by non-compliance in other. And therefore, if you make a mistake in one area, you're likely to ratchet up the risk assessment and be faced with additional cost of compliance and dealing with additional CARs. And I actually find tax to be very challenging, because if you think about, not only does the tax legislation keep evolving, but the world keeps evolving. When I was planning to deliver this, I decided that I would do a big thing in cars, and I chose the Ford Motor Company as an illustrative example. And having written the paper, did Ford not come out with a whole new series of engines that made all my paper writing and research on Ford motor cars completely irrelevant? But the underlying principle is that it's better to have a low emission car than to have a high emission car. But even then, giving somebody a reward by way of a low emission car could come back to bite you when you see what's coming down the line with increased tax rates. There seems to be an incentive by the government sometimes to encourage people to do one thing, and having done it, they jump up the tax very, very considerably. As I said, I think this morning's session is to say that tax is changing and it's complex. I was actually talking about bringing down, or I was thinking to myself this morning, I'm going to bring down a copy of the tax legislation. And I got into my office with the tax legislation, which is 18,000 pages worth, this height. And I picked it up and I thought, no, I'm driving to Bristol from Edinburgh. This is going to mess up my fuel economy something awful with the sheer weight of it. So, it is difficult. But as we go through the rest of this session, what I want you to think about, some of you will remember the group Bananarama, and some of you will remember the group Fun Boy 3, and they had a joint hit. I'm not going to sing it, you can relax. But it had a joint hit, it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. And in tax, that is actually a great truism. It ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. And there's going to be a mixture of some horror stories and some happy stories. And the good news is there's a happy ending to this morning's session, but in between, you might think that Stephen King has written some of the script and there's some horror stories about. Personal service companies are now going to be under attack. And yet, if you've given advice to arrange this, you could be faced with unscrambling eggs. How do you unwrap this? So I follow this kind of principle. Keep it simple as far as possible, and always keep looking at the advice that you give. Again, if we know that an attack is coming, you could advise those clients potentially at risk of being found to have a relevant engagement. Have that mutuality of obligation. Offer, say no. Offer, say no. Accept. That's established a no mutuality of obligation. Build in a real right of substitution, which is incompatible with being an employee. You're more or less home free. But even better, you can emphasise the bits like able to bring expertise and function autonomously, a lack of control, and make a case for saying this is going to be advantageous to avoid any problem in the future. Because as I said earlier, a dispute is time consuming. A dispute on average, when you're looking at status or IR35, takes 8 years from when it starts to when it gets to the tribunal. And really, that's not to anyone's advantage. It reminds me of that terrible joke. What's the difference between a Rottweiler and a tax inspector? Answer, the Rottweiler lets go. The taxpayer keeps hanging on. And my advice is don't allow that to get into the equation. So, outline. We're going to be looking at a flexible remuneration package, but we're also going to be considering the capital allowances that are available to the employer. And we're going to be looking at some of the easy, plain vanilla type of arrangements that you can take advantage, and particularly using salary sacrifice examples to sacrifice a bit of salary to, in return, receive a change. But again, this has all changed, and with effect from last July, you've got the AstraZeneca decision and HMRC saying now money forgone could be a payment for a service, and so you have to consider the VAT implications of the salary sacrifice to what you receive. And that's going to bite particularly on things like childcare, whereas if the business was partially exempt, it could affect the recovery of any management fees associated with it. It could also affect things like the second-hand bicycle scheme, where you're now going to have to account for VAT when you sell the bike or the service in providing it. and it could affect canteens. And again, we saw 2 years ago now the change in the childcare vouchers, whereas you previously had an exemption of £55 a week, £243 a month, and you get higher rate tax relief exemption on it. New ones taken out after April 2011, they don't get the higher rate tax relief, and therefore you're getting a restriction. But the good news is the old ones still continue to be able to get it. I had going to be covering employee share options, but the vast majority of these are underwater. So it's in the paper, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them because in practice, share option schemes at the moment are just not a commercial option except for those exceptional businesses that David was describing earlier, which are bucking the trend. Most of the other businesses, the share option schemes are under the water, and they're just not being used at the present time. So trying to structure a remuneration package is very important. It's best done in the most tax-efficient way and the most efficient economic way to make sure that the bottom line of the business profitability is kept as high as possible, but it will also help keep the employees feeling rewarded and valued and, of course, retaining them. And it is important to realise that not all benefits suit all employees. I always remember years ago being present when an announcement was made that an employer was going to give, this is many years ago now, going to give everybody of a certain grade a company car. And I saw this red-haired lady who was just sort of totally cold about the whole thing. And I walked up to her name was Wynne, and I said, Wynne, I can't help notice that, you know, you're underwhelmed by this announcement. Why is that? Are you not excited about the prospect of getting a four-wheel rocket like a Golf GTI? She turned around to me and said, no, I'm not, because I don't have a driving licence. Mm-hmm. And that was an illustration of a reward being given which simply wasn't appreciated by the recipient. You've always got to balance up the complexity with the administration cost and the simplicity and certainty. And a fixed reward package can actually be a valuable incentive at the point of recruitment, and it's a lot easier to administer than the more complex flexible benefit schemes. And the administrative cost of flexible benefit schemes has again been illustrated last year when they changed the rules on VAT so that you've got the extra complication. And I would always say, don't be tempted to take advantage of every new wheeze, because it can be just purely temporary. Remember, they introduced the exemption from computers, and when everybody said, this is great, we're going to play computer games, they withdrew the exemption and said, no, it's a taxable benefit. So you've always got that difficulty that tax law and technology does not stand still. But the advantage, as I say, of a fixed scheme is simplicity, lower cost of administration, certainty. And the advantage of a flexible scheme is that you can target the rewards and the benefits better to the employees, who will appreciate them more, but it's a lot more administrative work. Salary sacrifices are essentially quite simple, and it's set out in the notes at page 3 that salary sacrifices work, and they are certainly worth considering. There's no rocket science here. What you're trying to do is to give up something, your salary, so therefore you're reducing, in particular, the employee's tax. You're reducing, in most cases, the employee's contribution for national insurance, and in all cases, you're reducing the employer's contribution for national insurance. So there's a significant saving, and sometimes that can be shared so that you can give a more advantageous benefit than the just a straight sacrifice would suggest. But it is very important, as I said, that you dot every I and cross every T and set it up correctly. And in particular, you need to give it up in advance. As it says, and it's confirmed in page 3 with a straight extract out of the revenues guidance, arrangements which are designed to make use of the exemptions within the Taxes Act should not be regarded as avoidance. That generally means HMRC will accept them, provided you get it right. But it's important that you do get the salary sacrifice arrangements right, and you should, if it's going to be more complicated, make sure that there is no possibility of falling foul of the ability to give it up And that's the old Heaton versus Bell principle, where if you can exchange a benefit for the salary and it's interchangeable, then you'll just be taxed as if it's salary. That's the underlying principle there. So you do need to make sure that you get this right. And as I say, post-July 2011, watch canteens, childcare vouchers, bicycle schemes, because there are VAT repercussions that could come back to haunt you in these particular instances. Benefits are very simple, really. Anything provided to an employee in the course of their employment, if it's salary, it's taxable and nickable. If it's a benefit, then the measure is going to be the money's worth. And that's generally going to be the cost to the employer of providing the asset if the title to the asset is transferred, or a measure. There are certain specific benefits have got a measure. It could be 20% of the market value when first made available, or there could be things like this car scale benefit. And I'll come back to the cars quite shortly. But something as simple as a DVD could be a valuable thing. And if you built up as an employer a DVD library and you allowed your employees to borrow some of the DVDs, the actual tax charges associated with that are so negligible, nobody would really bother about them. Because you're talking about a penny a day. And who wants to keep a DVD longer than the time it takes to view it? So you can actually provide something at relatively modest cost that is valuable if your employees are interested in looking at that. It's an illustration of just a wee bit of lateral thinking in these areas. But if we move into the more common areas, then the obvious point is company cars. And the cost to a 40% taxpayer is, the Ford Mondeo is £3,805, and for a Toyota Ago is £1,315. Now, how that's been worked out is at the back, and I can't remember if it's Appendix 1 or Appendix 2, but you've got the calculation in there, and that includes the provision of fuel to the employee using a company car. And what I would say is that these days, unless the employee does an enormous private mileage, way in excess of 20,000 miles a year privately, it's not worthwhile giving them company fuel anymore. But you've got to be very careful. If any fuel at all is reimbursed by the employer, then the scale charge could apply. I remember an experience years ago, which I had personally because I had a company car and I used to tour around Scotland lecturing. And I had gone to Aberdeen and I put in my claim for the mileage. And when the pay-as-you-earn auditor called to look and examine it, I confidently said, well, let's have a look at my expenses claims, confident that they would be absolutely okay. And the pay-as-you-earn auditor picked up my expenses claims for Aberdeen and said, you have claimed 350 miles for a trip to Aberdeen. It's only 128 miles from Edinburgh up to Aberdeen. So the return trip is 256 miles. You've claimed 94 miles. You've triggered off the scale charge. And I could feel that horrible thought, you know, have I got it wrong? What on earth has happened here? And I sort of reeled out in embarrassment and shock. And then I went back and looked at my work diary, and I'd actually been in the Aberdeen area for a week, and that was the total mileage. And I came back and I said, look, there's the business diary. You can see what I was doing. I was visiting various firms all over the place. But the fact is, they challenged it. They were so pernickety. They were trying to impose the whole scale fuel charge on that one bit, because they said, provide any fuel and you're going to face the whole scale fuel charge. So you need to be quite careful with company cars. You might say that's a horror story. But in 2009, there was a case, Mr. Whitby and Mr. Ball. They actually went to their employers. They previously had company cars, and their employer said, we don't want the hassle of this. We've actually got a leasing company, and we will lease to you, the employees, company cars on exactly the same terms as anybody coming in off the street.
There's no discount, there's no difference, same as everybody else off the street. And they said, OK, we'll do that. And in return, instead of getting reimbursed at the mileage rate, if we take a Golf TDI of 9p a mile at that time, they got the approved mileage rate of, at that time, 40 pence a mile. It's now 45p a mile. You would think, yeah, that all makes perfect sense. They've made a commercial decision. But then the revenue came along. And what they said was, this is a company car. It's a car provided by your employer. And section 114 to 118 of ITEPA 2003 takes some reading because it creates a fiction. If your employer gives you a car or the use of a car, it is deemed to be by way of your employment. Now, we're all sitting there saying, but it can't possibly be. They paid for it as the same as every other person in the street. How can you cause that to be a company car? But actually, the deeming provision catches it. Now, by concession, the revenue then said, we will allow the lease payments that you make against the company car benefit, which more or less wiped out the company car benefit. But what it didn't do was wipe out the scale fuel charge, because they'd made a wee mistake occasionally, and they'd been a wee bit generous in their business mileage claim, with a wee bit sometimes of home to work in those business mileage claims. So it triggered off the whole scale fuel charge. And you might say, well, what's he getting excited about? Well, Mr. Whitby then faced a tax bill, an assessment of £74,652 as they went back 6 years. And I can assure you that's something to get excited about. In tax, it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. And if the employer provides, then it's deemed to be by way of the employment. That was actually reinforced in a case called Stanford Management, where the company decided to give its two directors Mercedes CLS 55 cars. Now, each of these cost about about 70,000 nice cars. For some peculiar reason, it was decided that the company would lease the cars. But all of the expense of leasing was actually charged straight to the director's loan account, which was settled up. All of the costs of running the cars were charged to the director's loan account. The only thing that was there was because Mercedes-Benz or Daimler-Benz preferred to lease to a company, you get a better rate leasing as a company than you did as an individual. But all of the costs of these cars were being paid by the individuals. So again, you might say if the company is not paying a penny of the charge, surely the revenue wouldn't tax it. And at this point, I expect, you know, Leslie Nielsen to leap up and say, don't call me Shirley. But anyway, the point is that they did tax it, and it went to the tribunal in 2010, case 98, and they said it is provided by the employer because the leasing agreement between Daimler-Benz was with the company employer. And even though the company did not pay any of the overhead costs, the scale charge applied in this case. And again, it can come back to haunt you. So you've got to make sure in taxation that you get it right. And again, it's very difficult because you can get things so badly wrong. It's a fiction how they tax company cars. I was actually interested in getting a big, fat, flabby car for, you know, what's obviously a big, fat, flabby gentleman. I really kind of had come to the conclusion years ago that I wouldn't fit in a Toyota Ego. I probably could, but I didn't think it would be too comfortable. And when I got my four daughters into the car with me, I thought it's going to be really, really difficult and the wife's just going to have to run along behind. So I was looking at a big car and I looked at a Chrysler 300 CD. And it so happened that commercially they were offering £10,500 off the list price. But it's a 35% benefit in kind. And when I looked at the economics, I would pay more in tax because of this fictitious list price than it would actually cost to have run the car and bought it myself. So you need to always do the sums and work these things out. But there are some very good benefits around. And just giving you an illustration, a Ford Mondeo, you'll get capital allowances at 20% historically, But the old Ford Mondeo is going to change, and it's down to 8%. Now, we all know that as soon as you buy a new car, the depreciation is horrific for the first few years, and that means you're building in a big timing difference between the written down value for tax purposes is going to be much more than the commercial value. Fortunately, the market reacts quickly, and as I said to you, Ford have produced a new Mondeo costing 18,100 with 114 grams per kilometre. They also produce, and again, working that one out, you can get the 18% allowance now, gives you 3,258. But your Toyota Ego at 7,200, you get 100% allowance. So that's a considerable incentive to employers. If you can identify a car with less than 110 grams per kilometre, then you can get a very good allowance for the employer. It makes sense to manage what cars are available. And I looked at this particular slide, just taking a Ford Focus as its specifications, and compared the written down value with capital allowances as the years go past. And you can get almost identical performance out of the different specs of the Ford Focus. But it's quite obvious that the most economical one with the lowest emissions is the one to go for, because that one, the one that's third from the top, the 1.6 Duratex TDCi with the start top technology, it costs a bit more, but you get the maximum 100% allowance for the employer, and you get a greatly reduced CO2 emission for the employee. If you got the model wrong, although the performance of the cars are almost identical, you've got 50% more by way of the cost. And, of course, you've got a lot more by way of the depreciation, the difference between what you're having to pay by way of tax and the deferred credit that you might get, because the capital allowances are so much less if you've got a higher emission car. The benefits in kind, as I say, are going to be quite dramatically different. And it's one of those areas where you can't just look at the situation of a car and say, well, what would be advantageous? It's going to be a detailed question that you need to work out the economics, not only this year, but of next year. And you need to make sure that it isn't going to come back and haunt you, because there can be an enormous difference. Let's take the Vauxhall Ampera, which has just come onto the market in May 2012, and it costs about £30,000 net of a £5,000 government grant, which means the list price is actually £35,000. It's got emissions of 40 grams per kilometre. So zero road fund, absolutely great. 100% first-year allowances to the employer on purchase. When the employee takes it this year, it's going to have a 5% charge in this year. But then look forward to 2015-16, and it's going to leap up to 13%. That means the benefit in kind on the employee is going to change from this year at 5%, that's 1,750, to in 3 years' time, when the car is older, worth a lot less, the novelty of it has gone, and the benefit's going to go up to 4,450. That is a disincentive to the reward scheme. So don't let short-term things influence you in a bad way. The tax system keeps changing, and the paper does contain an outline on the childcare benefit, but I've already briefly recapped on that and how it changed in 2011 for denying higher rate relief. At the moment, I was amazed driving down yesterday at the number of double cab pickup trucks that are thundering down the motorway. And I spoke to a friend of mine who has one, and I said, you actually just drive down the motorway from Glasgow to Hamilton, where you work. Why do you have a big double cab pickup truck? And he said, it's all about the tax benefits. And I said, you're going to drive that tank in an urban environment, because it's a very, very big vehicle, because of the tax benefits? And he said, absolutely. It's a taxable benefit of £3,000 with a fuel charge of £550. It makes sense. And I said, well, what about parking it? He said, well, you know, he drives from home when he's got a garage to work when he's got a parking space. It makes perfect sense to him. But if he ever had to go out in business and find a parking space, it might make a different matter altogether. What about some of the plain vanilla schemes that are available, or opportunities? I shouldn't call them schemes. And again, we're all faced these days with the need to keep up to date. Continuous CPD. I'm talking to an audience of converts here. But the good news is that if your employer pays for, you know, CPD for training, it's exempt under Section 250. And that is actually very, very valuable. The slide begins with a case of Mr. Perrin, who was a trainee ACCA accountant. And he was almost successful in getting the tax deduction, but almost is not good enough in the tax world, and he failed. But it's interesting to then read about Dr. Banerjee, who succeeded in getting the tax deduction because her contract of employment was a training contract, and it was part of her job not only to deal with patients as and when they came in the door, being supervised to deal with them, but also to attend lectures. And because her contract of employment meant that when she was going to lectures, it was part of the training, even though she incurred the expenditure herself, she got a tax deduction. Whereas in the paper, there's the story of Mr. Perrin, and there's the case of Sharnock, and there's the case of the consultant psychiatrist, who all failed because the test of getting an employee deduction where the employee pays for it is very stringent. Section 336 has been described as almost nothing at all when you analyse it, and it's very difficult. You have to incur the expense in the performance of the duty, and wholly exclusively and necessarily in the performance of the duty, which means each and every holder has to get the deduction. It's much easier to get the exemption under Section 250, where the employer pays for it. And the thing about work-related training is it will cover the obvious things if you're interested in tax, going to a tax course, but it can also be used for much more diverse things like your driving test and driving tuition, or martial arts classes for personal protection, or language courses. There's a great deal of creativity. And equally in these things, there's no need to actually suffer hardship. You can make it quite a pleasant experience to go on a training course, and you will get an exemption. So it's often very worthwhile to consider that as a route. Environmentally friendly transport, pool cars. An employer can make available pool cars, but actually be aware that HMRC have been challenging this. There's a classic case in Scotland. I read the decision, and I have to say that, you know, the decision that the first tier tribunal has reached in this particular case is in my view, amazing. It was a mistake by HMRC. That's the only thing I can say about it. Because I would begin from a premise that if I was a compliance officer and I went along to an employer, Industrial Doors Scotland Limited, and I was looking round the car park and I was introduced to the managing director, Mr. Brian Gagaro, and I looked at the BMW 5 that was sitting in the car park, BG8, I would be a cynic and think, that's not a pool car. That is being used by the managing director. But he said, oh yeah, hands up, I'll take a benefit charge this year. But you've got no evidence of the earlier years. And the tribunal said, that's right, there is no evidence as to what was happening in the earlier years. So they escaped a challenge on it. But it is an area where HMRC are challenging. And they do say they want you to keep a mileage log, but there's nothing in the statute that requires a mileage log. But I would suggest it is important that you can demonstrate that the pool car conditions are satisfied that it's available to all, is not used privately, and you can therefore make it available occasionally to an employee who might be going on a business journey. They could take it home, for example. Work buses, an exemption. Subsidies to public transport, an exemption. Bicycles and cycle safety equipment, again an exemption. But do remember, the VAT rules have changed here, and there's a supply being made by the employer that you would have to account for VAT. And again, canteens available to all, there's an exemption. Free meals on a cycle to work day, there's an exemption. So there's a lot that's simple shopping exercises. Just carrying on with those simple shopping exercises. An event, Christmas parties, even a golf outing, so long as you remain within the £150 a year, it's exempt. Professional subscriptions, irrespective of amount, if it's an approved body, it's exempt. The employer can pay it and it will be exempt. Financial advice up to £150, exempt. Eye tests and corrective glasses, exempt. Relocation costs, exempt up to £8,000. Now, the interesting point about relocation costs is that when they changed the law in 1993, they carried out research. And they went to the CBI and the Institute of Directors, and they said, how much does it cost to relocate an employee? And in 1993, for the Institute of Directors, it cost £33,000 a year. For the CBI, it cost £28,000 a year. For the civil service, to relocate a civil servant, it cost £16,000 a year, but they introduced a cap at £8,000. So the idea is it's better than a kick in the pants, but if an employer reimburses an employee's relocation costs, it's capped at £8,000. And it's very important that any employee who is relocating and has helped with that relocation and gets more than £8,000 is reminded of the need to return it, because it is taxable. Dr. Wald is an American surgeon who came to work in the UK, and his employer gave him assistance with relocation for just over £16,000. Now, in America, the culture is you file your tax return quickly. So he filed his tax return quickly, as Americans tend to do. His UK tax return, this is. And he omitted the fact that he got more than £8,000. Now, I would say that's a simple mistake. And for a simple mistake, you shouldn't get a penalty. But HMRC officers, they're cynics. And they have different expectations. And in the case of a doctor, they expect a doctor to be highly literate and highly responsible. And the bar that they set for reasonable care, they said, Dr. Wald failed to take reasonable care and we want a penalty. And the tribunal upheld that view. Now, I don't know if you've looked at the guidance notes that accompanies the tax return, but they're... beside box 15, it clearly states any excess over £8,000. I actually read it recently just to sort of see what it did look like, but I haven't read the guidance notes on completing a tax return for years. And it just shows that they expect you to do it as and when you complete your tax return each year. And Dr. Wald, as I say, faced a penalty. I'll come round and tell you about some other sad cases before we get to the good news at the end of the thing. But it's worth remembering that the standard that they set for taking reasonable care varies from person to person. Canteens provided to all are tax exempt, as is free parking at or near the workplace. And again, that can be a very useful valuable exemption. Beneficial loans up to £5,000. Are tax-free, go over the 5,000, it's a slab test. 5,001, you pay the official rate of interest on the 5,001, but it's exempt if it's under the 5,000. So again, it's important to be careful and to make sure that you look carefully at any advances towards expenses. But you must never, ever let the commercial dog be wagged by the tax tail. And you wouldn't actually lend £5,000 to everybody. You know, you've got to sort of say, in theory, that is available, but don't throw away 100% of your money in the promise of a tax saving. It's got to be a sensible arrangement with a good security of getting your money back. Mobile phones, up to one now. And the good news is that HMRC have recently announced that smartphones, which, you know, they argued before were computers, are in fact a mobile phone, and therefore one is exempt. But do watch for private calls and the need to analyse the bill. And remember that the law can change, so we need to keep looking at these things. And second and subsequent phones, they're all going to be taxable post-April 2006. Long service awards, if you've done 20 years... Now, actually, employment trends have changed so much that not many people these days do 20 years with the same employer. So it's quite right that you should celebrate it if it happens. And in this case, if you've done 20 years, you can give somebody a tangible asset. You can't give them cash, but you can give them a tangible asset up to 20 years at £50 is £1,000. I remember one of the Institute employees was very keen to have a particular ring, and it cost £1,400 in the jeweller. And I walked down to the jeweller in Edinburgh and I said, would there be any prospect? And I explained that we would pay up to £1,000, you know, for this piece of jewellery, but we couldn't go beyond it because it would make it taxable. And the jeweller reduced the price down to £1,000, and I was delighted to, you know, give him a cheque. And the employee thought that, you know, basically this was absolutely fantastic. But it indicates that sometimes you can get a very good buy if you're quite fixed in the price that you're prepared to pay, and you're open and upfront about why you can't move from that particular instance. And that was obviously a case of, the jeweller wanted to sell and his profit margin would take it. I saw another example recently where somebody had done 20 years and they got a huge widescreen TV. And it was hugely appreciated by the recipient and all the members of the family. Company vans I've already covered. You can actually get quite a good deal. I got an interesting query from an ICAS member, and I make no comment on the morality of this, but he wanted to know what was a company van. And I said, well, what have you got in mind? And he said, well, I was thinking of one of these small vans. And I said, no, they're commonly used, you know, by people as a means of transport, so they won't qualify. We got round to a transit, and I said, yeah, well, if it's got a payload of over a tonne, it's definitely a van. And he said, right, I'm going to get a transit. And I said, forgive me, Bob. I know the guy quite well. I said, why on earth would you swap your company car, which is a very large Mercedes S-Class, for a transit van? And he said, I'm in the throes of divorce, and I want to get my income down. And I thought, there's nothing stranger than people. But sometimes, you know, that's a case of he had a definite reason for switching to a company van, albeit that I still can't believe he would give up an S-Class Mercedes for a Ford Transit van, but he did. So, dispensations can save the employer an enormous amount of time and money. And basically, if you can get a dispensation to cover it, it reduces costs, but more importantly, it gives certainty on reimbursed costs in particular. And I've set out in the notes some of the scale rates that you can get, and again, it makes administration quite a lot easier. And sometimes it can be quite appreciated by the employees that they get these sums by way of a scale payment, and it makes the whole thing a lot easier. I've given you an example in the notes of Mr. and Mrs. Dumpling, where Mr. Dumpling, who is on £50,000 a year, I'm always fascinated because everybody thinks that everybody else earns more than everybody else does. And the reality is, if you earn £50,000 a year, you're in the top 5% of earnings in the UK. Most people think that that's a kind of average position. But this is an example of somebody who's up in that top 5% of earners, But he pays out of his after-tax income various expenses, some of which are work-related, and so his net earnings are $31,824. And then the next example is Mrs. Smart, who gets an employer to provide all the same benefits. And in this particular instance, she's got a tax saving or a better take-home pay of $3,690. Now, you'd all be sitting there thinking, who's going to get particularly excited about having your bottom line take-home pay increase by $3,690? And I can assure you that individual will appreciate that. But more importantly, doing it right can, across a workforce, can actually achieve substantial savings for everyone. Now, as I said, shares and share options are largely underwater. But again, there have been significant changes to the EMI regime, where at the moment you can get up to 120,000. And if you meet the conditions, the good news is, subject to getting approval, you're going to get the entrepreneur's relief, which means an effective tax rate on any gain inherent in the shares. But at the present time, the vast majority of share and share option schemes are underwater. So I've put it in the notes, but I wasn't going to spend a lot of time on this particular aspect. I was going to comment briefly on the EMI, just reminding you that they've extended the conditions and it's up to 120,000. They're proposing to make it even bigger. It does seem to be flavour of the month. But as I said, you can read about it in practice at the moment. The vast majority of these schemes are underwater and they're not particularly attractive. But the principle is attractive. The grant of the option is tax-free. It's NIC efficient. There's no NIC when the option is exercised. And when you finally sell the shares, then you could get the benefit of a 10% tax rate on entrepreneur's relief on any gain that's taken in the period of growth. Golden hellos is another thing. And you can do it in a tax-efficient way or you can do it badly. And I suppose I began being interested in golden hellos when I looked at the old case of Peter Shilton, who was the England international goalkeeper, and the case of Shilton versus Wilmhurst. And he got an inducement to move to another club. And he argued that this was not a reward for the services that he'd given his previous club, and therefore it was taxable. And the revenue said, no, anything that is done to induce you to give services, past services or future services or present services, is a reward for those services and it's taxable. And that's basically the position. So back to it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. And in Silver versus Charnock, a lady studied successfully for an MBA course and she incurred expenditure in taking her successful MBA course of £18,000. And when she went to her new employer, she said, yes, I will join you, but I would like you to pay the costs of my MBA course, £18,000, and I'll work for a salary. Was the £18,000 taxable or not? No, it was specifically for training. And an MBA course will be within the exemption of Section 250. Therefore, she got £18,000 tax-free as a golden hello, and her salary for the future. It's not what you do, it's the way that you do it. There's a case of some pilots who incurred training expenditure when they had to keep up to date with their pilot experience on flying airliners. And the rules for these pilots were, if they left their employment within 5 years, they had to reimburse some or all of their training expenditure that their employer had incurred. So these pilots duly reimbursed their employer for the training expenses that had been incurred, and they are eye-wateringly large amounts, actually, and then duly claimed a tax deduction under Section 336. But that was doomed to fail from the outset. What they should have done is go to their new employer and negotiate with their new employer, you pay those training costs, it's tax-free. And that means there's an enormous saving there. So you get the tax-free training costs reimbursed and then you negotiate your salary going forward. It's the way that, you do it in tax that gets the best result, and you need to be alert to how to do things. That leads me into the final chapter, and I had promised you a bit of good news as we move towards lunch. And yes, the lunch is, of course, the good news. But what I would say is that as we move into termination payments, there's a very common misconception that you can get the £30,000 exemption as easily as falling off a log. And it's not true. The first point of challenge is for the employer. Why was this payment wholly and exclusively for the purposes of the business? So you always have to document the reason why it satisfies that test. And the most common one is preserving the goodwill of the remaining workforce is why you do that. But you've got to address why it would be deductible to the employer. In that case, you're addressing the whole amount, why it's deductible to the employer. But you then look at the recipient's point of view. And of course, if it's paid to them under a contractual term of their contract of employment, it's going to be taxable in full. If it's an ex gratia payment, remember, ex gratia means there's no contractual right to pay it. You have first of all addressed why it's going to satisfy the employer's deduction. But if you can now say this is an ex gratia payment, you get the first £30,000 tax-free. If it's for injury and in health, document that very carefully at the time, because there isn't any £30,000 cap on injury and ill health. But people are often very reticent to admit to their ill health, especially if they subsequently make a recovery. So if it's for ill health and it's over the £30,000, the good news is you could maybe get all of it tax-free, but you need to document it. And if you don't document it at the time, then you could find it quite difficult to prove that it was made on ill health grounds. There's a very interesting argument that the revenue put forward in these ill health cases, and it comes from a case, Horner versus Hasted, where the revenue say it must be solely on the grounds of injury or ill health. And actually, you can apportion, as Mike was saying this morning, you can apportion a payment. And you can say, well, a portion of this was for the ill health element and the other part was for something. And that other part may well be taxable, but you can, if you can identify the ill health. And again, it's worthwhile looking up the legal cases and compensation to say, well, you know, we can't put something that's totally unjustified. But if you can link it to past decisions of legal decisions, then you can get quite large amounts through on ill health. The other thing about termination payments is that HMRC have confirmed that they will give certainty. And that means you can write to the employer's unit and say, I propose to make somebody redundant. These are the arrangements. If it's a compromise agreement, will you please confirm that the payment of the first £30,000 will be paid gross? Now, I don't know your experience on this, but my experience on this is they are dreadful. I remember on one occasion I wrote to the employer's unit, set out the circumstances, asked them to confirm. And I thought I was being really good because I was giving them 6 weeks' notice. And the next month went by and it was 2 months to go, and I sent them a reminder saying, this is really important. And then we got to the deadline, still nothing from the revenue. So we had to take a view, and I took the view that the first £30,000 was going to be available. I actually made a complaint about this to HMRC 5 months after the person had departed. They came back and confirmed that the £30,000 was exempt. So in practice, they offer this service, COP10 for redundancy. They will confirm and give certainty. But in reality, you often won't get that certainty in the same commercial time span as you're getting rid of the employee. So you have to take a view. Basically, HMRC accept that if there's a compromise agreement, then the first £30,000 will be tax exempt, and they're pretty relaxed about this. But again, termination payments are one of those areas where, in the case of Dr. Clinton, she had been ill for some time, and she took the view that she had a case for constructive dismissal, And so she gave up her job, and she sought compensation from her employer of 3 months of salary. And the amount involved was £9,662. It came to the tribunal in 2009. In economic terms, unless you're going to do the work pro bono, to take a case properly to the tribunal, it's going to cost you around £10,000 just to go to the tribunal with a properly prepared case. Now, I said there was good news, and she won. She did get the £9,662 treated as exempt. But I would suspect that the personal cost of dealing with the tribunal would outweigh the happy result there. Again, in the N.J. Wood case, this was a case where the compensation received was £37,424, and it had been achieved using a compromise agreement negotiated and settled with ACAS. And the revenue normally confirm if there is a compromise agreement, including the terms, I hereby give up all my rights for any compensation, it will be within the 30,000. But for some reason, they decided to challenge this one, and they lost. And it just emphasises the point that getting the £30,000 exemption is far from easy. So always be prepared to address all the issues before the payment is made, to document it at the time, and therefore you avoid dispute, because disputes are really quite unwelcome. And I think in tax planning, you have to have your thoughts well organised. I began by commenting on Ed Lester and the student loan company and using service companies and profit extraction. But as Mike was saying earlier, with the PA Holdings decision, I think the future there is much harder and certainly much less certain. You can often, in many employee situations, use a service company to provide benefits. So you could set up a wee service company and you could use that service company to provide childcare vouchers, free car parking, a number of things, and that's a valuable way of remunerating part of the things in a tax-efficient care. But do remember, if you're going to go into the arrangement to make it tax-efficient, you have a higher standard of what's expected of reasonable care. And also, I would say the big scary thing is the HMRC, in my view, based on evidence, and I'll tell you the evidence in a minute, but in my view, HMRC are getting harder to satisfy on reasonable care. I'd mentioned to you Dr. Wald, who left out of account the excess over £8,000 in his reimbursed expenditure. He hadn't received his P11D because he got his return in quickly. In America, relocation costs would be fully tax deductible. He made a mistake, but the revenue sought and got a penalty. Paul Goldberg was an individual who was frankly clueless. If you ever read the decision, it's an absolute horror story. You can read it in the 2010 editions of the first-tier tribunal. It's case number 346. And in this case, Mr. Goldberg got £76,872 by way of a termination payment. And he took the mistaken view that this was exempt. He left it out of his return. He was completely ignorant. When he went to the tribunal, he didn't even know enough to bring along his contract of employment. He was demonstrably not well advised. And so it was inevitable that he was going to lose. But the difficult thing in this case is not only were the revenue going to get the tax, they were seeking a penalty of 25% of the tax, which is punitive. Now, I told you there was some good news at the end of it. And the interesting thing is, they tried, this was a termination that occurred in 2004, and they tried to get the new legislation to be found in Schedule 24, Finance Act 2007, to get a failure to take reasonable care. They should actually have been using the old legislation of Section 95 TMA 1970 for negligence, And because they tried for a penalty under legislation that didn't start to apply until the 1st of April 2009, the revenue failed. That was good news. But you could tell the judge was trying to be sympathetic because he suggested that Mr. Thurgood could have had a compromise agreement and he would easily have got the £30,000 exemption. He didn't even know to do that. And so Mr. Goldberg faced tax on the £76,872. But the good news is he escaped a penalty. But to end on a really happy note, the revenue had a concession. And the concession is that if you get if you set up business and you operate it through a limited company, then by concession they will take profits from an office, in this case a sub-postmaster's office, and they will accept it passing through the limited company. So in the case of Mr. Singh, he was approached by post office counters who offered to pay him just over £89,000 to relinquish his sub-postmastership. Now, the sub-postmastership is an office. And Mr. Singh accepted. And he knew that this was an office. The first £30,000 was exempt because this was in all the documentation from post office counters. But he put into the company accounts the balance of £59,000, which he said was a capital gain of the company. And he was prepared to pay tax on that basis, included in the profits of the company. Now, the revenue came along and said to Mr. Singh, this is wrong. You can't have the £30,000 exemption in a company. It's only available to the individual. And they had a dispute and it went to the court. And the tribunal looked at the case and said, Mr. Singh had made a full disclosure of all the relevant information. And any HMRC officer of average experience had to know precisely what was going on. And in this case, the £59,000 was not appropriate to be included in the profits of the company. Therefore, the company's profits were reduced by the £59,000. The news gets really better because they then turned around and said, Mr. Singh had made full disclosure. He told you everything. You didn't take action in good time. The inquiry window is closed. There is no prospect of making a discovery assessment because there's been no negligence. There's been full disclosure. You're out of time to assess Mr. Singh. And so the good news is that he got the whole lot tax-free. Tax is complex. It's about attention to detail. And there's a great opportunity to make things tax efficient. I hope I've given you a few seeds for thoughts on what I would call the plain vanilla areas this morning. And I'm now quite happy to say thanks for listening. I'm very happy to take any questions that might arise. Over to you. And if there aren't questions, we can all go to lunch early, so don't feel obliged.
Somebody was on monthly salary, that all of that sum of money that you're paying out is initially tax deductible as an in-month earning, and then the individual do a tax repayment claim on the revenue. Is that true?
No. About 2 years ago, they changed. It used to be that when somebody was made a payment after the P45 had been issued, the payment was then basic rate tax. Mm-hmm. And the recipient would then have to claim back the basic rate tax. And the revenue changed their policy a bit over a year ago, not quite fully 2 years ago, and they made it now a zero coding, which means that higher rate tax has to be applied to payments to a former employee after the P45 has been issued. So if in that situation you were dealing with a higher rate taxpayer, it would be at the 40% rate. It depends on the amounts involved. And the coding instruction, the default position on coding has changed. It used to be if payment was made after termination, you deducted basic rate tax and you left it to the employee to sort it out. It's now, it's no longer basic rate tax. You could have a higher rate tax liability, and it will be to the employee to sort it out. It depends now on the amounts that were involved. Okay? Yes?
You said about the £150 that you can use per employee. Is that prorated if they're not with you for a full year or if they don't work a full hours per week, they're part-time?
The hunt, like a Christmas party?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a very good question. I'm going to stand here and say, I don't honestly know the answer to that. I'll give you my sort of intuitive reaction. And it's a de minimis threshold that was set by the Inland Revenue and HMRC was a concession. And it's £150 per employee. I knew I should have brought the copy of the Taxes Act down with me because I could have looked up and given you a definitive answer. It doesn't matter, I'm absolutely certain about this, it doesn't matter if they are part-time or full-time. It's £150 per employee. So if it's a part-time employee, they've still got £150. If it's a full-time employee, it's £150. My intuitive reaction, and I'm sort of 95% certain of this, but I don't honestly know, is that even if it's a part year, if it's per employee, and therefore an employee who was only there for part of the year will still get the £150 exemption. Because
the event took place.
Sorry?
It's when the event took place, at the time.
How many employees?
It's not going to be tested at the end of the year how many employees times 150. It is the employees during the course of the year. If he's there all the time, must not exceed the 150.
Yeah.
But if at any one time, if it was one event and one or two employees left, it's still 150 times the number of employees.
Yes, yes, that's right. It's more importantly, there's no chronology to the events. So if you had three events that actually exceeded the 150, but two of them didn't, you can select which of the events, and the chronology of those events doesn't matter. It's a deregulatory £150, and therefore you look at it sometimes with the benefit of hindsight and pick which of the events would be the most beneficial to use, and you'll get the £150 exemption for it.
Thank you.
Well, if not, lunch is beckoning for... Oh. Yep.
Are there any particular rules around that, or can you just, for example, can I get my glasses through my company?
Do you operate a computer?
Do, yes.
Yeah, well, yes, is the short answer.
Oh, okay. But I don't have to provide that benefit to all of my employees then, for example.
No employer has to provide a benefit. It's a matter of contractual negotiation as to what rewards that you would make available, but I would suggest to you that most employers will now allow free eye tests and free glasses if they are necessary for the use of a VDU for all of their employees. It's one of those things, I suppose at the end of the day, you would be weighing up if you don't do it, and an employee came back and said, my eyesight has been damaged because I had to use a VDU, then you could be facing a much bigger claim. So I think the general feeling is that most employers now make available to their employees free eye sets and free eye tests and free glasses. But for example, if the glasses, I'll use myself as an illustration. I can read perfectly well without glasses, so I don't need to have glasses. But if I decided that for some obscure reason I wanted to have glasses that were, the most amazing Elton John type style, then you wouldn't ever get a tax deduction for that because it's not in relation to the use of a VDU.
Can I just ask, about the job director within the company who works from home, would he be able to claim any private use of his home or electricity or anything like that to go on his PLMV and then be taxed for?
Ha 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 ha. You see, that is a very interesting question. I could have digressed into areas. There are directors who have obviously converted their home into an office. And there's a number of tax cases that have actually looked at this particular issue. And the court basically looks at the benefit in kind of the expenditure incurred on a domestic property and say it's an assessable benefit, which I think is a very bad decision. It's a very uncomfortable, unfair decision. But your question was, if you were a director, could I claim a part of my domestic overhead expenses as a deduction from my employment? Well, the short answer is yes, you could, but you have to base it on realistic figures. I came across a case quite recently where an individual was a management consultant and he claimed one third of the domestic expenditure of his home. And it wasn't a great surprise when the revenue challenged this because it was a 42-bedroomed house. It's also a bit difficult to argue it with a straight face, I have to tell you. So you can claim a legitimate and sensible amount of the expenditure if you have set aside some use in your house for the business. And, you know, you do the bookkeeping there, you do all of that. You would get a tax deduction. But in tax, you have to look at the totality. And I would always say if you set it aside as exclusive use, you'll lose the only or main residence capital gains tax exemption. So you never set it aside for exclusive use. You know, you might use one room one day and another room another day, and that entitles you to a proportion, but you're not restricting your capital gains tax exemption in the property.
I have an office at home, but my grandchildren come and do their maths homework in it on my computer while I'm working. You know, it's available for family use.
Yeah. Well, you'd be able to, you know, claim a sensible proportion of overheads without putting at risk your cap.
Is it a time proportion and a room proportion, you know, an area proportion?
Yes. So long as it's sensible, then the revenue will allow you a deduction for it. Well, that looks like all the questions, and it's got, I make it 3 or 4 minutes to lunch. Thank you all very much for listening. I hope you enjoy your lunch.